This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It is a Thursday, which means it's our Reporters Roundtable Day, where we get reporters from the local media, and also, too, coming up with Eric Weddle from Indiana Public Broadcasting, talking about some of the major issues here in Northwest Indiana and elsewhere through this week. With us to start things off, we have Greg Tejeda, who is the reporter that covers events that happen in the city of Gary for the Post-Tribune. Greg, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking again.
Very much.
Well, first off, let's start out talking about some of the latest activity from the Gary Redevelopment Commission. You had a story in the Post-Tribune about that, and it's dealing with a road that not many people are probably aware that needs to be repaired. It's among many roads that need to be repaired in Northwest Indiana, but Airport Road in particular is not only heavily traveled, but it also, I think, at least when you think in the view of the airport, people would like it to look very, very nice, and I guess that's one of the things that they're dealing with now is doing some renovation work on Airport Road. Tell us where the Redevelopment Commission fit into all of this.
Well, the situation is that the Redevelopment Commission actually controls the construction, even though it's airport property. So the Airport Authority and the Redevelopment Commission are splitting the local cost of the project. Each of them has to come up with $509,000, and then the Indiana Department of Transportation comes up with the remainder, 80% of the total cost of the resurfacing project. And that road, as somebody who's driven on it regularly, is so pockmarked, so heavily bumpy. There's times I wonder if my car is going to lose something, if something's going to wind up falling off. You know, it is a long overdue road repair that needs to be done.
I think probably, as you no doubt do, the most people that take the route are the ones that take it from Klein Avenue into the airport. So you're going east, and that is not only an area that is just the stretch that leads to the airport itself, but it's also a driveway. It's a road that leads off many driveways to a lot of trucking companies and other businesses that probably their trucks beat up the road probably just as much as the other traffic that was on it too, don't you think?
Definitely. You know, this is going to be a road that they're going to have to keep an eye on in future years. They're going to have to make sure it gets properly maintained. But you've got to start the maintenance somewhere. You know, it's going to need good expansioning, a widening, servicing. In fact, there's even going to be a bridge that just to the west of the airport property, a railroad bridge, that's going to have to be ripped out to allow for that widening. It's actually a bridge that has been in place since 2 years before Gary was incorporated as a city.
Has it been paved over or something, at least over time?
It's going to have to be ripped out so they can widen the road.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you've got the EJ&E tracks that are in the area, too. It's a habit in the area, too, so I know that just kind of messes everything up, too, I would imagine.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So what have they mentioned at the meeting and that your understanding is from the folks in talking with NDOT as to when they would like to get this project started, since they have at least some of the local match already taken care of?
This is expected to start in June. Mm-hmm. It's going to be in the next month or so. And it's once they actually get in the way, that road's going to have to be reduced. At one point, it's going to be cut off a bit. It's going to be a mess for the next remainder of the year.
Well,
getting to the airport,
Which
I'm sure is going to lead some people to make jokes about how nobody uses the Gary Airport. But, you know, we want to be nice. You know, it is a project that needs to be done, so it's an inconvenience that's going to have to be borne with.
Well, we have to get used to that. We know that this time of year is when we see all the road repairs and construction and reconstruction work that's underway. And now with the state legislature coming up with the infrastructure funding mechanism to be able to pay for more road work to be happening all across the state, we've been promised we're going to smell asphalt a lot. I imagine it'll probably start in very soon. I would imagine. One of the other topics I know you brought up in stories this week, also concerning, I guess, the Gary Chicago International Airport, is how they're putting to use some of their property that's aside from the runways, but it's still on the airport property that's being used as vehicle storage space. Tell us how you found out about that and what you've been told by the airport about this.
They have approved a deal, or they're in the process of approving all the details of the deal. With a company, CLR Auto Transport, which is based out of Merrillville, which apparently has an agreement to store these Volkswagens that have a defective emission system until they can be fixed. And the way it's going to work, they're trying to set it up as that these storage these cars are going to be stored at certain points across the country. And it seems that the property, the Gary Airport, is going to be where Volkswagens from across the Chicago area are going to wind up being held until they can figure out how to fix them so they can put them back to sale and get them out into the public.
Now, from what you understand, what is this area look like? It's obviously on the airport property, and I don't know, is it something that maybe you can see if you're traveling on Klein Avenue as you get close to Airport Road? Of course, you'll get to slow down if they start doing work on Airport Road, I guess, if you're trying to make that route, but you'll probably get to see the cars or the trucks there? Yeah.
You do see it from Airport Road. Actually, it was some open property that in recent years was being used. It's where they stored the assorted construction equipment that was needed for the runway expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, now that the runway is, that project is complete, that equipment is off the property, so it's kind of just some extra empty space that's sitting there. So they figure it's a nice way of getting this Merrillville company to pay $12,000 a month for use of the land. Talking about 23 acres out of the total 763 acres that are the airport property.
I probably give plenty of places for vehicles to be parked for the time being, I would imagine. And then I'm assuming that it's probably up to CLR or whoever else that they happen to be working with the Volkswagen dealers as to where those vehicles are brought back in, I guess, for the whatever work needs to be done. I guess the emissions. Well, I think most of them have the ones that have faulty emission systems, aren't they, I believe? And
yeah.
Then so that means that they'll have to go into some shop someplace and get fixed. So obviously they can't be resold until the recall repairs are made, I'm sure. That's not the airport's problem. They don't have to worry about that. They're just letting them use the space, I understand. So.
Exactly. Ultimately, CLR is the one who has to figure out how long it's up there and the process of making the emissions repair.
Mm-hmm. I know that you also covered recently here one of the latest Gary Common Council meetings. There are a number of issues that have been brought up, and I know one in particular that brought some controversy or at least some comments on was the ordinance that was passed that creates the city of Gary as a welcoming city. It was quite a bit of discussion about that, and some people that still have some very strong feelings about that. Not that they're against immigrants by any means, but just the way that this is all being set up. Tell us how the discussion went at Common Council about the welcoming city problem.
There were some council members who were very outspoken. Council President Ron Brewer, Councilwoman Levita Sparks-Wade, both of them made it clear, you know, they had their problems, they had their concerns, they had their objections. But a majority of the council members seemed to be swayed by, how can I phrase this? They don't want to be on Donald Trump's side on the immigration issue. They want to be sympathetic, and they were afraid that if they started voting against us, they would put Gary in the perception of somehow being a hostile place towards non-citizens.
I imagine they probably felt, as you say, they're sympathetic, and they felt maybe the same way that the Chicago Mayor Emanuel feels, but not quite as strident about it. And they're not going to declare themselves a sanctuary city by any means.
Nobody's doing that anymore. I mean, communities that are taking a decision now are going for the welcoming city route,
mm-hmm.
so they can make this statement without having to, I don't want to say put as much teeth behind it, but it leaves them a little bit of leeway to talk, negotiate.
What were some of the other issues that came up here at the recent Common Council meeting besides this ordinance to create the welcoming city?
They also, with much debate, approved a measure to give permission to a doctor who wants to create a group home for people upon their release from the Lake County Jail who have minor mental health issues and who are homeless, need a place to stay. And that had some members of the council rather upset that, you know, do we really need to be bringing more people from the jail into Gary? Of course, the argument was made that a lot of these people, their last permanent address they had was in Gary, and mm-hmm. they merely wanted to come back to the community they considered home. And when you also consider this particular group home is has a capacity of 6 residents, it's not exactly the largest scale of project that could be taken on. But the council did ultimately approve this, even though Council President Ron Brewer, again, was an outspoken critic on this issue as well.
Have there been a discussion come up at council lately here about some of the economic development projects that are planned or underway in the city of Gary to try and bring more jobs back, more businesses back into the city?
I can tell you about this measure, which is actually going to be coming up in the council. The Redevelopment Commission has already approved an agreement with a company based out of Chicago Ridge, HMV Trucking, which wants to relocate from Chicago Ridge to Gary. And the Common Council is now considering a measure that's going to come up at their next meeting, the first week of June, in which this company wants to relocate to a site on Texas Street. And they say this could bring at least 200 new jobs, you know, truck driving jobs, you know, that would have a connection to Gary, would create other work, you know, from local residents, and could expand beyond that. You know, this is something they're doing. This is an effort they're trying to finalize the details on. It could be happening in the next few months.
That'd be very interesting. We'll look forward to seeing your stories in the Post-Tribune about that. It's more good news. I know that Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson has been working very hard to attract new businesses in and get new businesses that will be in turn bring some skilled workers in and people that can be trained for these jobs as well, too. And truck drivers are always in demand, it seems, and more so now than ever. So it'll be interesting to see if the council goes along with this plan. It's nice to hear that. We've been talking with Greg Tejeda, who's a reporter, covers the city of Gary and other topics for the Post-Tribune. Greg, thank you very much for spending time to talk with us here about some of the issues that have come up before Gary Common Council and some of these other things that lately seem to happen all around the Gary-Chicago International Airport. And looking forward to catching up with you again here on some of these other stories that you talk about in the future. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Taking a look at some of the stories around Northwest Indiana for this week, and we have next with us in the studio Lakeshore Public Radio Stephen Lattimore, who's been covering some of the interesting stories and looking at some of the other topics as well that he's kept an eye on here recently. Stephen, thanks for joining us today on the program.
Glad to be here, Chris.
Well, let's take in the big topic first here about the latest involving the lead contamination problems in the city of East Chicago. We know a lot of these are also dealing not only with the contaminated soil in particular neighborhoods, one neighborhood in particular, but also, I guess, the problems now. They're talking about the state of drinking water in the entire city. What's what you found out here certainly about these?
Well, there are a number of groups that advocate for cleaning up the water, and they went downstate to talk to IDEM, and they came back concerned. As you look at the federal budget that's being approved, there's talk of cutting the funding for the Great Lakes restoration, and putting back those responsibilities to the state. Well, after the meeting, some of these groups came back with the feeling that a lot of the standards that have been set by the EPA to make sure that that things are okay in terms of the environment, that the state is pushing back from a lot of those guidelines. Part of the reason why they had to go down there and remediate all that soil is because the EPA said, you know, you need to do it at this particular way. They also, you know, pinpointed the issue with the water. And IDEM is saying, well, we don't know if we necessarily want to go with that guideline. So they came back troubled and concerned. They're set to meet with the EPA to try and mediate both of those and maybe get a sense that EPA will say, okay, IDEM, look, you really need to make sure you do these things to make sure that you keep those standards in place. Some of those groups are also going to be part of an event in Chicago this weekend, the Poor People's Campaign that was started by Dr. King. That's continuing. And that some of those groups will be there talking about environmental justice, the idea that a lot of the issues that have happened in places where there are people, brown and black people, you know, and how that's an issue that they need to be mindful of and do what they can to fight against that. So that's some of the stuff that's going on as it relates to the lead issue in East Chicago.
And we know that Governor Eric Holcomb came over to the region here last week to do a ceremonial bill signing of the measure that had already passed the General Assembly, and he officially signed into law offering more assistance to the city of East Chicago dealing with some of the cleanup costs and remediation costs that you've been talking about. And a lot of those problems, of course, dealing in particular with the West Calumet neighborhood, where the worst of the contamination it seems to be still. And I know that's what they're working on the remediation right now.
Right, yeah.
One of the other issues that have come up here in discussions here lately, dealing not only with the water problems in East Chicago, but the fact that there are fewer and fewer, at least has been historically, veterans organizations that have had home bases in Northwest Indiana. There used to be quite a few veterans, foreign wars posts in the region. A lot of them have closed up for whatever reason, and we understand that at least in one instance it's reopened, or one at least one of them is reopened. Tell us about that.
Right, and Gary, there was a post, let me see if I have it right here, it's 2151, was one of the main posts in Gary. And the person who was running it, it became a paper post, which is on paper only. It wasn't really that active. And then the person who was running it passed away after a car accident, so it wasn't very active. And a group of folks headed by Victor Baker, who is the commander of the post, actually has restarted the post. Mm-hmm. He's now in the process of trying to get. New members. And it's interesting, you think, well, you know, what's the big deal? I'm not a veteran, so I don't really have all the particulars on that. But I got an education, because there's a number of things, a number of benefits out there that veterans are available for, but a lot of them don't even know that they're there. Mm-hmm. And they serve as a conduit. He gave an example of a young man who was discharged, and he was discharged a certain way from the armed forces that cut off his benefits. He had no clue of that. And so through working with the VFW, they were able to get his discharge changed, and as a result of that, he was able to go back to school. So that's a big deal, you know, being able to use those benefits. Were it not for the VFW, he would not have been able to use those benefits.
Well, that's interesting. It's interesting. And I imagine that with the fact that we have another VFW post open up here in the region, in Gary, in this particular case, it's likely to maybe, if it doesn't increase membership at the existing posts, whether they're VFW posts or American Legion posts or other military veterans organizations, that'll be good news. We'll get more membership, more people coming out, and maybe if there's some posts that have closed up, other than what we mentioned, they'll reopen too, I would imagine.
Yeah, he in talking with them too, I also got a real understanding of sort of a shift that's happening in the armed forces, in that a lot of the older veterans, Vietnam veterans, are not really making the connection with the younger veterans from Desert Storm, Desert Freedom. Stuff like that. And so there's sort of a gap there. Mm-hmm. And what they're trying to do now is do an education campaign so they know, okay, you know, yeah, maybe you don't want to be sitting around in the VFW hall, you know, drinking and smoking and telling war stories, but you still need the VFW to help mediate some of these issues that you have, because, you know, if you try to go to the VA, you may not get, you know, what you need. You go to the VFW, they'll be able to actually walk through some stuff. In this case that I had mentioned, they were actually able to go through Visklosky and Donnelly, who are on the Armed Services Committees, mm-hmm. in the Senate and the House, and work those issues out. So they were a good liaison. An advocate for the veterans.
Now, Tom Pappas, who is a representative of the City of Portage's Veterans Committee, comes on, of course, on Regionally Speaking on a regular basis to talk about issues here in the region and about their particular meetings that they have every month over in Portage. In fact, he'll be back with us here on Regionally Speaking next week to talk about what's coming up at the next meeting. But he brings up these topics as well, and he mentions often, too, about the fact that there's a notable disconnect between the generations, less so between the World War II veterans and the Vietnam era veterans, but the greater between the latest people who have come back from service, whether it's just recently they've just been on active duty and they've come back after serving their time, or they had participated in the Gulf Wars, and trying to connect in with the people that are back home that can help the most.
The way Mr. Baker pinpointed it for me is that a lot of the younger veterans are actually still in the workforce. Mm-hmm. And they have families, and they have activities that they're doing. Whereas the older generations, those guys are retired,
mm-hmm. or they're only working maybe part time.
Exactly.
So they have the time where they can be with their friends at the post and all. And the younger veterans don't have that. Interesting. So it'll be interesting, mm-hmm. to see how successful that new VFW post in Gary turns out to be.
Another thing too that they want to do is actually be a part of the community. There are a number of scouting programs that they'll try and institute to get to get a connection with the community to help support it in that way.
We're talking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore about some of the stories that he's covered here on the air and keeping an eye on as well, too. One recent report that you had out here was how an organization here in Northwest Indiana does its best to work with young people to get them familiar with the workplace, that maybe these are people that don't have connections to jobs or they don't have connections to possible careers, and that's what ACR is all about. They just had a recent, visit to a business in the region. Tell us about that.
They did. They went to a place that helps developmentally challenged people work and become more independent. And the whole idea of the ASEER program is that they get young people's feet wet in various careers with the idea that maybe they'll decide, hey, maybe I want to go work in social services. I was with them at another event where they were at a doctor's office and actually saw someone getting procedures done, getting their blood pressure checked. And the idea is if you have a guy who has or a young lady who has that kernel that, hey, maybe I may want to be a doctor or a nurse, they actually get there and see it, and they either say, oh, yeah, this is a good idea, or, oh, absolutely not, I don't want to do that.
Well, it's better to find out now than
right,
realize
better to find out now.
That you can't stand the sight of blood or something
right.
like that, I guess,
yeah,
and
yeah.
you don't want to get into the medical profession and maybe thinking that it was nice, but it would be an interesting career, but then realize you're not cut out for that, too. And I know that you had one comment from a young man who was very much interested in computer technology,
right.
and he saw the potential opportunity for a job in the media.
Right, exactly. And you know one thing, too, that sort of stuck out from the story was the board members. You have people who are really involved in the community, business leaders and entrepreneurs who are taking their time to sort of just sit these people on their knee and say, hey, think about this, and to expose them to things that maybe they weren't aware of to broaden their horizons. I think it's a pretty good opportunity for the young people.
Well, I'm sure that you'll stay in touch and you'll find out about more visits that the groups have and have people come in and bring young people into various businesses in the region and finding out what opportunities there are for careers out there and why it's important to stay involved in school. Certainly,
right.
the very least, this to just stay in school, period.
Yeah.
But very involved in learning these opportunities that will lead to some very good careers and make them better people and get them out of perhaps some financial jams that they've unfortunately had been in with their families. Who knows what's going to happen? Good for that. Lakeshore Public Radio, Stephen Lattimore with us, talking about the stories that he's worked on here. Reporter Roundtable Thursday. I'm Chris Nolte, and with us now is Eric Weddle. He's a reporter from Indianapolis for public radio station WFYI, and he also reports for the Indiana Public Broadcasting stations as well. Eric has been keeping an eye on a lot of education news here in the past few days, and he is with us from Indianapolis to talk about it. Eric, thanks for coming back with us today.
Thanks for having me here.
Well, let's start out here with some interesting topics, which, of course, are involving not only the state, but in this one particular case, we have local schools that are involved in this. This is a concern that the state school superintendent, McCormick, is concerned about having enough members on the State Board of Education. We've had a prominent
right.
member who, of course, he was on the board because of his experience locally, and he ended up becoming a state senator. We're talking, of course, about Eddie Melton. And the
right.
vacancy is still there. When he became a state senator, he had to drop off the State Board of Education. What's the latest concern that that Superintendent McCormick, and I'm sure probably her colleagues on the rest of the board, have about having fewer members?
Well, you know, I think in relation to Mr. Melton, I think the big concern is, you know, he's overseeing your area, the first congressional district that is having the major concerns right now, the Gary School. Facing a takeover from the state because of the financial problems and the lead crisis in East Chicago. So there's really not a voice right now from someone from that community to speak with the board members at these meetings when often the board has questions about what's going on there. So Superintendent McCormick would like there to be someone picked very soon to kind of bring the concerns from the superintendents and the schools and the people to the state board.
This discussion, I guess, has it been ongoing as best as you can tell that ever since, at least since Superintendent McCormick has taken office? And of course, the vacancies, like in this case with Senator Melton, has been going on for some time.
Yeah, I mean, it's been 5 months. So, you know, he and another member of the board who resigned to become chief of staff for the superintendent, both last meeting was in December. So they have not been in a meeting since January. And the board has 11 members, including the superintendent. So 10 are then appointed are appointed through either the governor's office or the two leaders of the state house.
Mm-hmm.
So for 5 months now, they've not had two members in this position. And the governor's office has said they're working on it, but I think a lot of people thought they would have figured that out by now, since this board right now is tasked not just with these issues in their communities, but they're tasked with figuring out this new ISTEP exam, figuring out the new federal regulations that the state's going to agree to follow.
Do you think that the concerns that Superintendent McCormick have are more procedural? Although I'm sure she is concerned about representation. She wants to see two very important areas represented, and in particular, of course, we're talking about our district up here with Eddie Melton.
Yeah, I think it's procedural, you know, and also just the fact that you know, the Gary area, there's so much right now going on there. There's so much focus from the state on, you know, what their involvement is. I think it's both. As you know, we discussed in the show a few weeks ago, there was a vote at the state board meeting earlier this month that was a 5-3 vote. Five members were for a topic, but since there weren't six voting for it, the statute required that topic not to be approved.
Mm-hmm.
So procedurally, you know, it can limit the board from taking action if there is a member who's absent.
One of the other topics that I know that you and your colleagues, in particular Claire McInerney, had covered here in this past week was a very high-profile visit by the U.S. Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, to Indianapolis. She'd come in for conferences, I understand, as well as a personal appearance at a school in Indianapolis on the near west side of the city that used to be an IPS school many years ago and then went to become a private high school, and it's now an interesting school as well. Tell us more about this particular school that she visited.
Well, yeah, so to back up this a little bit, earlier this month, I and a reporter at NPR, Corey Turner, and another reporter in Bloomington with the Indiana stations. We did a series. We did a very in-depth look at the private voucher issue, the private school voucher program here in Indiana, basically because Secretary DeVos and President Trump have talked about wanting to expand that program across the country, and Indiana right now has the largest private school voucher program. And one of the schools that we went to was Providence Cristo Rey, which is the school you're referring to,
mm-hmm.
and it is a private Catholic school in Indianapolis where nearly every student there receives a school voucher, which basically means the state gives that school a chunk of money to help pay for the tuition costs of the school. And we profiled that school in the NPR story that aired nationally, and Secretary DeVos then chose that school to visit this week. As she talked about how there needs to be changes in the American education system to give parents more choice in where they send their school. So she didn't take questions at that event, but I think she chose that school because it's a school that is targeting low-income families, and the way that they're funded through private donations and vouchers allows these students to basically attend for free.
And we know that the Indiana State Teachers Association had their own things to say about Secretary DeVos's visit. Of course, their stand very much against the voucher program because of the impact that it has on public school systems.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this law was passed in Indiana in 2011. The Teachers Association, they filed a lawsuit against that. They went to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court, they said it was constitutional. But since then, there's still been so much legal fighting and just opposition from the teachers union on school vouchers. As you know, the way the program works is if a student lives in the Gary school system and they choose then to leave that and go to a private school, the money that would go to the Gary school system follows that student to that school. You know, and some school districts are seeing a large amount of money that are leaving that, such as Fort Wayne School District, especially, is one of the largest cities in the state that is using the voucher program.
I know, Speck, that was I mentioned that was one of the stories that was highlighted in the series that you and your colleagues with NPR had covered as far as the voucher program is concerned. Take a moment, tell us a little bit more about the situation in Fort Wayne and why, even though it seems to be far away, certainly from Indianapolis, but even from us here in Northwest Indiana, there are a lot of things that are very much in common that people should be concerned about if they aren't already.
Right. So, you know, so right now, as I kind of explain, you know, how the voucher program works is people choose to go to a private school, and the money that that student would typically have assigned to them in a public school district, they take that as a voucher to pay for tuition at a private school. And right now, Indiana is spending about $146 million on private school tuition. In Fort Wayne, that number is $20 million. So $20 million in Fort Wayne is leaving the Fort Wayne public school system and going to dozens of private schools in the Fort Wayne area, which is has a large Catholic population, and there's many, many Catholic schools who are in the voucher program. As part of our series, one of the things that we really wanted to look on was, is the voucher program fair in terms of equal access to all students who do want to choose that and their families? Can they leave their public school and be accepted into a private school system? And what we found is there are ways that a private school can say, no, you cannot attend here, even if you are using the public funds and that school accepts public funds. So students who have severe disabilities or who maybe have a behavior issue, when they come to a private school, that school can actually say, you know, sorry, we don't have the services for those students. And that's kind of one of the issues that we kind of wanted to drill down on, was saying, is this an equitable system if some of the parents who truly do need extra help, like a special needs student or maybe a student who is not succeeding at public school, if they can't go to the private school system, is the choice program really equitable?
We're talking with Eric Weddle, who is a reporter for WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis. And he, along with his colleague at the IPBS level, Peter Ballin and Rosen, and Corey Turner with the NPR Ed site, have been working on a series of stories dealing with school vouchers, school choice, as we know is an important point that the new U.S. Department of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has been bringing up and the topic she's brought up here. Eric, thanks for spending time with us to talk about these stories. We hope to see more in the series come out, too, and we'll be able to carry them, of course, being an NPR member here at Lakeshore Public Radio. Thank you for talking about them today.
Great. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune has been covering a number of stories that have been in print online as well, and we want to bring these up here on Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Carol, thank you for being with us here on the program today.
Hi, Chris. Thank you.
You're going to be a very popular person. You know, a lot of stories you and your colleagues have been writing here about what's happening in the region, and one in particular, let's start out first on the list to take a look at here. We've been covering schools first. Let's talk about the interest that officials at the school city of Hammett have in perhaps joining their colleagues in Hobart sometime this fall in asking voters for assistance.
Yeah, the trend continues. Hammett is the latest, and they've got similar to Hobart, they're going for a capital projects referendum and an operating referendum.
Have they, I'm sure, like many school districts here in Northwest Indiana and elsewhere in the state, seen that it's a good decision to tell your voters, tell your patrons as much as you possibly can, as early as you possibly can, before they're asked to go to the polls for these special elections?
Well, definitely. Those are the folks who are going to get the bill when you undertake a project. And some of the districts who have been unsuccessful, that's what they found out. And I believe they're sharing that advice with their peers in other school districts.
Mm-hmm. In the case of the city of Hammett, you talk about some improvements being made. And I understand, too, that one of the big changes would be to demolish a very historic high school and do some replacement there. How does the school city of Hammett break out their capital improvement plans?
Hammett is talking about a new high school that would replace Hammett High. And they're talking about putting that at the site of Harrison Park on Holman Avenue. So that's the big segment of their capital projects plan. They're also looking to downsize themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. And in Hobart, what's the request based on there, too, since it's a similar project?
Hobart wants to build a new elementary and get rid of Ridgeview Elementary, which is their oldest elementary. And there are many problems with the school. It's not accessible for disabled students. It creates a lot of problems there. And they just think it's time to build a new school.
Mm-hmm. I recall a conversation, and this has been seemingly a long time ago, with the Hammond school superintendent, Walter Watkins, about a lot of these financial issues. He was very vocal and very outspoken at the time about his view of the fact that the state has not been kind to any of the public school districts in the state, in particular to the big ones, and in places like Hammond and Gary and East Chicago and cities where the residents are many of them are lower middle class or middle class or even lower in the economic scale, and they need the help more than anybody else. And their youngsters need the help more than anybody else, but that help does not come to the school districts from Indianapolis. And he was very, very vocal about the fact that I guess at the time, I don't think he had thought about having to go the route of a referendum, but he wanted to find ways to be able to get around this. And I'm sure that you've probably, in talking with superintendents, have gotten that same message too.
Yeah, Superintendent Watkins in Hammond has been wanting to close Hammond High, which is 100 years old, which is a pretty old school. He's been trying for at least 10 years to come up with ways to do this. When they first started thinking about it, it was, of course, when President Obama came on board, and, of course, we were in a recession at that time, and it was just not a good time, and other referendum projects were failing left and right, so they did not go forward with it. Like other, not just urban districts, but a lot of districts are feeling that they're not getting a lot of support from the state at this time, so he's not alone.
One of the other stories I know that you covered, besides these education stories involving the school districts in Hammond and in Hobart, was another story for the city of Lake Station, where they've been trying to make some changes, I'm sure, finding ways to better handle their finances. And they've, I guess, set up a new contract with a new ambulance provider. Tell us how that is shaping up and the thinking behind it and how that's going to turn out.
Yeah, Lake Station's old ambulance provider was... It was Prompt, and Prompt notified Lake Station that their contract ended in June and they were going to cancel it because they were unable to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And the city started looking for other providers, and they settled on this company called Kurtz, and Kurtz is out of New Lenox, Illinois, but they are migrating to Indiana. They do operate in Highland right now. So Kurtz offered them the best deal, and that's the one they're going to start with beginning June 1st.
Have you heard in talking with other folks that we find more of these companies like this, smaller ambulance providers, as you say, here in this case, coming right across the state line, they're looking to take advantage of the growth of business that's happening here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, I'm not sure what Kurtz's motivation is. I do know that Prompt was not receiving a subsidy from the city, and that was probably part of the reason they couldn't make money. In Kurtz's case, the city is going to be subsidizing up to, I think it is about $85,000 a year if needed, if Kurtz isn't able to generate revenue from the billing. The city will back that up. Hopefully they won't have to, but that's the offer that's part of the contract now.
Mm-hmm. Do we know when the new ambulance service is going to take effect in Lake Station?
It will start June 1st.
Good. We'll see something.
Kurtz will have its ambulance at the same place Prompt housed theirs, and that's at the fire station number 1 by City Hall.
Carol Carlson is with the Post Tribune covering some of the stories for us on Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday that we can find online and in print in the Post Tribune. Carol, thanks for taking time to talk today, and we'll be back with you probably very soon with some other stories that you're covering as well, too. And
okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's time now for our Region Business Report as we bring you here during a Reporter Roundtable Thursdays on Regionally Speaking, and returning, of course, to Joseph Pete, the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Joseph, let's talk first about how we see more outlet stores opening up, and I guess the latest one that's coming into Northwest Indiana is I guess a store within a store. Tell us how Macy's is fitting into the equation these days.
Yes. Macy's, they're closing stores across the nation, but they're actually investing in Hobart. They're going to open a first of its kind for Chicagoland and Indiana. New concept, or it's a discount. They describe it as a mix between an outlet store and a department store. It's called Backstage at Macy's. Some people might be disappointed in the sense that, oh, they might perceive it as a downgrade, like where, you know, it's going from a full-line department store to, you know, markdown outlet items. But it's a relatively, the store within a store concept has been flourishing in department stores for some time now. Often they'll be in partnership with brands. But in this particular case, it's a new concept Macy's is trying out. It's only going to be 17,000 square feet of the 165,000 square feet that the store is. So most of the store is going to remain a full-line department store. It's just they're going to have this like splashy area when you first walk in, kind of trying to appeal to a younger consumer where it's got everything's marked down from 20 to 80%. It's a mixture between like, you know, last fall seasons, last season's fashions and various discounted items. They say they'll still have some regular items and some that are, you know, there before they even go to the regular department store. But it's trying to appeal to a younger consumer. They're going to have, like, juice bars where people can charge their phones and things of that nature. And they're really playing up the Backstage, like, theme. It does reflect a broader trend in Northwest Indiana retail. We have seen the Nordstrom Rack that came into Schererville and right. the Talbot's Company store. Like, a lot of the... it's a very challenging environment right now for retailers nationwide. More stores are closing than opening, and the stores that seem to be opening here often are, you know, outlet or discount focused now. It's not necessarily like a reflection on the thing we have bad demographics or anything, though, because it's like, you know, we are getting companies like Nordstrom that are coming in here, and they're pretty well regarded.
Oh, yes, they are very much so. They're storing in downtown Indianapolis. Even though you wouldn't think that such a big store like that would be successful, they still are doing very, very well down there. So Nordstrom's in general is succeeding as well, too. And you talk about the fact that we're seeing this trend for more outlet stores popping up here, as opposed to if it's going to be a brick-and-mortar store, that seems to be the trend that it's going to these days. I also know, too, that was on the wire not long ago about the fact that the recent financial report coming back from Sears Holdings is that things aren't quite as bad for Sears as they thought. They're still not out of the woods financially, but they're not sinking into the bigger abyss over their finances here, at least in the recent quarter. They did pretty well.
Well, yeah, that's very good. They have closed a lot of their region locations, unfortunately, recently. Mm-hmm. They've been doing that to kind of improve their bottom line. They did shut down. They had a location. They had a home store in Schererville on the Boulevard and another one in Valpo. That they've shut down as they continue to like shrink their footprint and reinvent themselves for the new 21st century.
We've noticed that there have been some problems with the retail outlets across Northwest Indiana, but as for banking's concerned, we see that the local banks are running supreme. In fact, you had a story about that in the Times here this week, talking about how the change has been made on who is Northwest Indiana's largest bank, and it's now a local bank. Tell us about how Centere's managed to topple Chase from the top of the list.
Yes, Centere describes this as a David versus Goliath story. In some ways, it is. Chase Bank is a huge international bank based in New York City, $2.5 trillion in assets. ATMs and branches everywhere all across the country. They've been pretty much the biggest bank in Northwest Indiana since they took over, I believe it was NBD at the time, more than a decade ago. That used to be Gainer, it used to be the Gary National Bank, but they just kind of walked into having 34 branches. You know, they have a big presence. What the Centere had originally just started out, its name, interestingly, is a combination of Century and Premier, which they got through a focus group. But originally it was like the first bank of Whiting. It was on 119th Street, small community branch, one location, capitalized with like $300,000. That was back in the 19th century in like 1895. Now flash forward 122 years later, it has surpassed Chase in terms of market share. It has 19.21% of the market share, $2.5 billion in local deposits. Literally one out of every five region residents has money deposited at Centere Bank. They really saw an opportunity during the Great Recession because there was that financial collapse. People were very distrustful of big banks at the time, and Chase had responded to that, as a lot of the big banks did, by they stopped making loans. Like, the problem was they took too many risks before, so now they weren't going to take any risks. They weren't going to lend anybody any money. So Centier started noticing a lot of former Chase customers were coming over to it during the Great Recession. And then they saw, hey, maybe we can finally, this is a realistic goal now. And so they set out, and now they've achieved they have managed to surpass Chase. Chase only has about $2.4 billion in deposits locally and 18.7%. And Centier has been growing, whereas Chase's growth locally has been a bit more flat. So this is one case where the community bank like reigns supreme over the local market.
An interesting side note that I've noticed about Chase Bank is the fact that, although I'm sure they've probably done it quietly, I don't know how many of their branches have closed up here in Northwest Indiana, but I do know that one branch that was very prominent on Ridge Road in Griffith quietly closed, and the facility is now up for sale. There's still a for sale sign out front of it. You see that as you travel on Ridge Road, and nobody seemed to know why the Chase Bank closed, but I'm sure that this is all part of the changes that they've had to make, because they've kind of lost their standing.
Oh, well, a lot of banks are trying to get rid of branches anyway. That's kind of they're in a very tricky position because fewer people are doing, especially younger consumers, are going into bank branches anymore and doing transactions in the bank. And they prefer to do it online anyway because it's less overhead for them. They have to invest in these IT departments, but they don't have to keep the lights on and pay maintenance and all these employees in a local bank branch. They would prefer people just go and do online or mobile banking. And then so what you see a lot is some of the bigger ones have been trying to cut back on branches as much as possible. Even Centier, which is growing, is building significantly smaller branches than it used to, even just 10 years ago, just because there's a generational divide. There still are a lot of people going to the brick and mortar, but it tends to be older customers. And then there's a lot of push now where people are just doing banking on their phones or whatever. And then, basically banks are not really adding new branches unless they're looking to expand into a new market where they don't have any presence, and then that kind of gives them a real high profile visibility. If you drive by and you see, oh, this is the Centier Bank or Fifth Third or whoever, it's almost like a billboard or a form of advertising.
That's interesting. One of the other stories I wanted to have a chance to talk with you about, and we may have to defer until our next opportunity to talk again, was a story that I'm guessing I didn't see it originally in the Times, but I know it ended up making the Associated Press newspaper wires, went nationwide. An interesting story that you did in the conversation with photographer Tom Hawker, who's quite a name for himself, was an academic here in Northwest Indiana, but probably not many people recall that he used to have a role as a public relations staff member at the former Inland Steel Mill, the Indiana Harbor Mill in East Chicago. Took a lot of pictures. A lot of those pictures are on display at an art gallery in Hessville right now. If you'd like to check it out there, you can look into that. And we're going to have to spend some time pretty soon here, Joseph, to talk about your conversation with Tom, the things that he told you, the brushes with death that you wrote about in the story that made the Associated Press wire. So I will make a note to myself, and we'll get back together and talk about that real soon.
Oh, yes. I would recommend, though, it's at the Chess Art Gallery, which is open from 10 to 5 Mondays through Thursdays and 10 to 4 on Fridays. It's in Hessville on Kennedy Avenue. Yeah. It's it's in the White Ripple Gallery complex. It's definitely worth checking out if you have any interest in steel.
Well,
very striking images.
Next time we will get together and we will talk about Tom Hawker and the conversation you had with him. We really appreciate that. Joseph Pete, who is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, thank you very much for once again being with us here on Reporters Roundtable Thursday.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Thank you very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you with a Best of Regionally Speaking presentation on Monday, and we'll be back with some new topic on Tuesday. Hope you'll join us for that.